Recording. I wanted to start by asking both of you about how you grew up, because you both kind of grew up under unique circumstances. Peter, I know you went to boarding school in Canada.
Yeah, I finished using that anecdote because...
You're done?
I've done, because I don't want to end up like that a guy, McCain, you know, who kept telling about how he was a prisoner of war. And now all we think about when we think about him is he was a prisoner of war. He can't raise his arms. Yawn. I'm not going over any upbringing that I went through for that reason.
Peter can raise his arms.
Can you raise your arms?
Absolutely.
Yeah. No.
I'm not going to even think about my upbringing because I'm 75 years old and I have a right to leave it dead.
You're right.
Okay.
Gary?
He can do what he wants. Well, everyone knows my background because I keep mentioning it every time I open my mouth for the last 30 years.
Let's skip ahead.
I've got to go into 4 hours of it right now.
Oh, no!
Church of Christ, American Indian dad, cowboy and Indian painter, belt whipping, tornadoes. That's enough.
Good, good. Check that off the list.
Yes, go on.
Well, Gary, you've talked about seeing Peter's work in art magazines as a kid in Texas. And Peter, I wanted to know, and it kind of blowing your mind along with stuff like the Harry Who, but I wanted to know, Peter, what you saw when you were, what kind of transformed your way of thinking when you were a teenager? And
Not art mags. It was pre-art magazines. 1950s, mid-50s, to going back to 40s. 48, I started painting, so let's see, 48, 56, when did I stop being a teenager? I'm not really sure, but anyway, to make a long story short, nothing about art really got to me because it wasn't any art magazine except the Art News, and the photos in Art News were black and white. They were that big, 1 inch by 1 inch. And all shows were treated equally, so that it could be de Kooning or Joe Smith next door. It could be anybody, just they got the 1 inch, you know, and they got the one paragraph about this long. So there was no way to be inspired by the art media that I could figure out. So I was simply inspired on my own, quite frankly. Life magazine was a big factor prior to TV.
Yeah.
And that stopped about 1950. I guess I was still a teenager. You know, this is so far back. Let's get up to the more recent time, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
I wanted to say was that people have kind of forgotten, or if you're not old enough, that art magazines looked like furniture magazines before, like Art Forum and stuff. They kind of like they were like antiques and paintings and stuff, and the ads. Everything was funky. And then when Art Forum happened, suddenly everything looked kind of slick and like a fashion magazine. And then you could kind of, oh, we're in a new world, new slick world now. But I saw Peter's work, I think, for the first time, maybe in Art Forum, Art in America, I'm not sure, 69, 70, something like that?
Yes, I coincide with the art magazines. They actually started to happen with pop art, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. About 62, 64 became a time for people to want to read that kind of stuff.
Were you reading that kind of stuff at the time? Because you were an active painter by the time pop exploded.
No, it was not available. I was living in Europe, and they weren't available.
Yeah. Well,
that's it.
Speaking of furniture, you've talked a bit about kind of wanting to make art that's not furniture art. And Gary, you've talked about kind of making images that really impact people and don't just blend in. And I wondered if you guys could talk a little bit about embracing, like, difficult painting.
Well, I don't know. I think for me, I was really seduced by the whole 20th century thing of, like, where do we go next? You know, it's an interesting game and conversation to try to figure out the next chess move sort of thing. Or it was also kind of like a land rush, you know, where you, like, run your covered wagon way out somewhere and then stake out, like I do, you know, Albers, squares and squares and squares for the rest of my life. And so I guess I was kind of like, trying to do that in a way, but so I don't know. I guess one thinks of all kinds of things that, like, you think, oh, this would sell, people would like this. And being from this difficult Christian background, I'm kind of like anti all comfort kind of thing. So I guess I'll keep moving my paintings to worse places and hoping for the best. But I don't know. You just make the paintings you think you can make. And I don't know.
Well, okay. In my opinion, content was kicked out of art when we started getting modern, started getting Mondrian-type things, you know, Malevich-type things. Content out. And I didn't want to see it go, frankly. So I just never was concerned with the design-type art, really. I wasn't afraid of not having money because I was brought up in comfort, kind of, you know. Always told how lucky I was. You're so lucky. You're going to have your college tuition when you need it, you know, and so on. So I was not afraid of not selling things. I just painted, quite frankly, things that I knew would be not popular. Never concerned me. I didn't feel brave or to be doing this. I went to Europe, had $1,000 and so on, blah, blah. I do think that content had to go somewhere when it was kicked out of art. And probably where it went was comics, to start with at least. And that's why you're here, because you crave, I don't know whether it's content or story or subject, something like that. You crave it, and you have to come here to get it for $10 or $4, because the stuff is in the Manhattan in the galleries doesn't have it. It may hint at it ever so slightly. You can see figures now, finally, but it took like 25 years to see those figures, because artists, generally speaking, fine arts types, are timid. They want to be liked. And I guess they're no different from any other young person, and it takes a certain level of being hostile, which I fortunately have, always have had, that enables me to not worry about that. You have to have some hostile attitude, or you definitely might as well forget it.
Do you feel kin to Robert Williams then? I mean, we talked about the show for a second, but he's kind
yes,
of
sure. I always
starting
look
juxtaposed.
At his work.
It was kind of like bringing imagery
yes, yes.
back.
Oh, yes. I always look at his stuff whenever I can, and I read juxtapose when I lived in Texas. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it since, actually, but I know it's around. Yes, then yeah. I met him a few times. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I definitely try to be aware of other artists, but a mistake I've made is not actually doing so. I only know about 5 or 6 artists, and that's enough. I haven't got time to know a whole bunch of people. I have to go start painting on my painting immediately upon leaving this room, and I'm very disciplined.
I noticed when I've talked to you before that you're like really excited about your next painting. You're very enthusiastic about getting back to work.
Yeah, so. I'm putting content in. I'm strongly involved in stories, content. I'm pushing it, absolutely. Really doing it.
Can you tell us what painting you're working on right now?
Yeah, it's called It's Not Cancer, and it has a doctor who's making an operation on a guy who hasn't yet been knocked out by gas, but he's just starting to fade. And the doctor's pulled out his intestine and cut it, and out comes a full steak with a knife and fork in it. And the doctor whispers in the guy's ear just as he's losing consciousness. This is a large painting, 8 feet wide. It's supposed to look real in a cartoony underway. Anyway, it's supposed to be, the doctor says, talk balloon, it's not cancer. You swallowed a whole steak. Because I like a painting that explains itself. Right. This is why I'm here. Because if the painting does not explain itself, they talk about it merely in terms of art style. And then they get into this thing. Peter Saul has been painting this kind of thing, this pop expressionism, since 1961. And he's still doing it, and he might be getting better, and he might not be. And they get into the art style, you know. They'll skip the painting 99 out of 100 times unless it's so clear that the actual viewer understands it. And quite frankly, most viewers don't understand what they're looking at if there's anything out of order. Like, they don't read imagery. They just read words. And so you have to take this into account, because in our society, an intelligent person reads the words and doesn't look at the image. This is a problem.
Dan, this is going to be really. This painting is going to be very dear to Dan, who was just in intensive care for 2 days. After
I swallowed a steak.
He swallowed a steak.
Yeah. What?
Seriously.
Last week.
Last week, I was in the hospital for 2.5 days.
He missed Thanksgiving.
It got stuck in my esophagus.
You're kidding?
No, they pulled out my intestines.
You what? Hey.
No, but it did get stuck.
Okay, I'll show you my painting when it's done.
I'd like to see it.
Okay.
It might be about me.
I'm going to ask something about this painting for a second. Like, I know that you're into rendering form and turning form, but it's not like a realistic space.
No, it's got to be pretty real, though.
It's dimensional, but it's not realistic.
It's got to be 19th century. That's done singularly, once and only. It's not just a quickie. If this is a thing that takes a month for a painting that's 8 feet by 6.5, it takes my time every day that I have for it. And it's supposed to have the charm of the fully done, like Monet, Manet, Jerome, those people. The charm of the completely done, singular picture. It's not a method of getting something to repro.
But it's not like, it's really not like 19th century space. It's some synthetic space.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean for it to be oomphy.
Yeah. I mean, you can enter the space.
Oomphy. I call it oomphy because it's not holding back in the way that things are when they're cool, you know. Things hold back. They don't give you the stuff. Right. They leave it to you to be intelligent. I'm not leaving it to anyone to be intelligent.
Good idea.
Hopping in, you know. Okay.
Charles Burns and I went to see your show in Philadelphia, and man, the colors were just cannot be reproduced, I don't think.
Well, that's a question that's very interesting because I do feel that the ink on paper is more convincing. You can't argue with it. I mean, the artist's supplies, I'm talking of acrylic and oil paint, were designed to show touch. And touch can be argued with. Like, if you had gone into Van Gogh's studio or something, you could have argued with him, and he might have paid attention. But presses can't be argued with. As soon as the technicians are paid and they press the button, the printing press will do absolutely what is told, and you can't argue with it. And it has a shellacky surface, and it has words beside it, which builds up power behind the image.
Right.
So it really can't be argued with. So if the comics were properly made, they couldn't be argued with. So I try to visualize an absolutely ideal comic, one that's been printed, really printed, not like I see it so often, you know, only half-heartedly printed and drawn and colored, but really done. I try to do that in paint and get the power of the... get that power that the printed thing has. Printed things have a tremendous amount of power. Also have a danger. Within half an hour, 25,000 have been printed, maybe. And then where do they go? You know, what do you do with this stuff? You don't know 25,000 people. It's just like paper. I mean, there's drawbacks. Plus, you have to start by talking about money, which is disgusting in a way. I mean, the comic book person has to begin by meeting people who talk to him about money, you know, where's it going to come from and all that. Actually, the art world is more sentimental. I've hardly ever talked about money, and I've been in the art world since 1961. I've hardly ever had to talk about money, just, you know, breeze by it. They're very sentimental, art world people, compared to comic book people, because I feel, this is my impression, comic book publishers are actually trying to make money. They're not already wealthy, whereas frequently in the art world, the person you're talking to is already wealthy. He doesn't need your help. What he wants is a little excitement, you know, a little excitement. This is misunderstood by the artist. 95% of the time, the artist says, oh, I've got to help this guy pay the rent. You don't have to help him pay the rent. The rent's already paid. It's not like the commercial art world where the people are only paying what they have to. If they have to pay you 50 cents, they'll pay you 50 cents. If they have to pay you $1 million, they'll pay you $1 million. But they only pay what they have to. They're not generous, not sentimental. That's the business world. That's why I stay clear of that. And only hang out with sentimental art world people.
Gary, can you talk about solid painting as well? Because that's something you and I have talked about making solid forms in paint and like with that authority of the printed object. Is that something you've...
That brought up something really I wanted to ask Peter, which was since you talked about reproduction relative to physically made, handmade paintings, were you seeing most paintings in reproduction? Was that part of it? Because I was in Texas. I saw it in drugstores where I saw, you know...
Well, I think there's so much wonderful improvement is possible because of the computer, I guess, or something. Even when my own pictures, after I finish them, I have to send a picture of it over to the computer. You know, my wife does it, actually. I don't know anything about it. But you take a picture, it goes into the computer, and then she does something that gives it added contrast, straightens it out, clicks it in. It's improved.
That's a better
No
painting.
Kidding. And I notice also the old master paintings, the 19th century paintings that looked lousy as late as 1965.
They in the
book, in the art book, in the art magazine, if you see Pissarro, Monet, Manet, those people, Velasquez, all everything past. If you look at it in a book, it looked lousy up until about 1975 or something, and then it looks great. I think it's the technicians going over the actual painting and fixing them up in the repro so that you really have some beautiful, realistic paintings, whereas if you were to see these paintings in the real, you wouldn't be so satisfied. They look saggy. Their colors are not what you'd hoped for. They have a grayness. It's gloomy. If you go to the Met, you can see this. You don't have to go anywhere, really.
So you were asking something about...
Yeah, your painting, because you've always... You've talked a lot about sort of making opaque paintings and with the authority of printed objects.
Well, yeah,
it's similar to Peter.
In some ways, I feel like I probably like lighten my palette, thinking it would get darker in reproduction, because it tends to get darker. Yeah, I think Dan published this giant book of my work 2 years ago, and it was all all these years it's been made for reproduction in a way. And then when the book came out, I went like, oh, I could darken my palette. And then it looked crappy, so I went back to lightening my palette.
Crappy which way? Crappy in the real or crappy in photo?
Well, if I lighten it, it looks better in the photo and in the real, but I can't make it look better than it does. It just looks like kind of flat. I don't know. I'm trying to stop a painting as soon as possible. I'd fuck them up. So I would like, if I can make one mark and have it be over with, I will, but I never do that. I go too far. My wife tells me to stop. Stop. Stop painting. Get a job.
Oh.
Yeah. Stop this one. An inspiration for me was living on the border of Texas in Brownsville in the 50s and seeing all those weird print jobs, you know, like off register, all special mixed colors off register.
Was that on purpose that way? Or?
No, I think they were just high. I don't know, impoverished, high, whatever, but they probably, I don't know, but they used to, that's what blew down the streets of Brownsville was Mexican wrestling posters that were been out in the sun too long.
And you both started out with a more kind of transparent painting style. I mean, Peter, you were much more sort of brushy and gestural, and Gary, you were too, sort of a lighter coating. And I wondered how that evolved for both of you. I mean, Peter, you kind of got solid by the
In my case, it evolved on the train going to Paris. I was down to very little money, and I thought, I have to do something. And the bookstores in Paris were all full of De Kooning books and other books of famous American current art, and I thought, gee, this must be a way to get ahead. I'll start doing it. And so I actually did the very next day. Previously, I had not done anything loose, but I began the next day. I simply took the canvas and spread over it a coating of medium so that it was dripping wet with medium, and then I went like this with brush strokes, and then I decided to make it look like stuff. I said, why not, you know? So I did icebox, stove, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I just did it. I mean, I wasn't thinking of art style. I was thinking of helping myself somehow. I never believed in any ideas. I just felt that I needed to do certain things, just probably like you do, to help yourself. There's a surplus of artists, always have been a surplus of artists. There were so many famous artists in 1950, you couldn't even remember all their names. There was already a fantastic surplus. The art schools already were full of people. So now it's just more of the same. So how do you escape being part of this surplus? That moment on the train, I thought, hey, I've got to do something. I've got to do something. And I feel this way periodically since. I feel an inspiration, you know, that comes to me to help me to not be surplus. That's the whole point. Because otherwise you're surplus, and then you got to be nice to people for sure. Proceed.
Thin painting. My work's always kind of thin in a way because I like... I love looking at Peter's work. It's always like masterful.
No, don't go
well
into that.
But I'm just trying to be nice.
But
I always like I don't like the shininess of acrylic paint. So I leave some of the. I only put two coats of maybe three coats of white acrylic on the bare on the raw canvas, and then I start painting, and there's still a lot of tooth, which dampens the shininess. And if I get it too thick, then the painting starts looking like plastic, which is the thing I don't like about acrylic. And if I don't go too far, then it's in some borderline that's still kind of matte looking because of the shadow of the canvas.
You painted in the acrylics all the way.
It's all acrylics. Yeah, I painted in oil paints when I was a little kid, but my dad does that. So
one thing you can do if you're dissatisfied with acrylic is go over it with thin glazes of oil. That's what I do, because the weak point of acrylic is the darks all start to look alike, you know. You're mixing these colors carefully and putting them on carefully, and they just come out eventually. If you go over it, well, I go over it like 7 or 8 times. After you've done all this, it looks surprisingly similar. Mm-hmm. Everybody's darks look similar. So I go over it with a thin oil paints, a thin glaze. So the last 2 or 3 days of my painting, I'm fixing up colors.
Is it the depth of the paint that gives it, that changes it?
The distinction,
it,
too.
More
the
colors
distinction.
The more
the oil paint helps the acrylic. It helps it, beefs it up. And I'm really pleased with that. I've been doing that since about 1983. Someone told me about it. Who was it? Somebody said you could do it. So I did it.
Oil, if you paint in acrylic, then your studio smells like rotten eggs.
Oh,
and if you paint in oil, then it smells like you're an artist.
Uh-oh. Bad news for me.
You just open a can of turpentine in the room and have the same effect.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about sort of your various circles. I mean, Gary, you came out of Texas and then moved to L.A. and were kind of involved in the late 70s and early 80s music and art scene there. Peter, I wondered, sort of, were there artists that you associated with in the 60s or people that
not
you felt...
Not enough. I had passing acquaintance with people in the Bay Area. I never felt accepted by the artists.
William T. Wiley.
Yeah, well, I never felt that he was going to be a better friend. I mean, the problem with these people is that they're always thinking about some sort of a career, you know? Is it good or bad to be friendly to you? So you don't know. I mean, I tried in the Bay Area to be part of the art world, but I don't think I succeeded very well.
Who was there at the time in the Bay Area?
All the artists that you know of now. Let's see, William T. Wiley, Robert Crumb, Arneson, Wilson, S. Clay Wilson. Now, him I know better than most. But the thing is, a mistake I've made. Everybody makes some mistakes. Okay, like they don't know how to paint realistically when they're in art school, and after that it's too late, so I'm not going to be painters, you know, and that kind of thing. Everybody makes some mistake. A mistake I made was not meeting anybody. I considered it a great luxury and privilege to be by myself with my girlfriend in a romantic city. You just walk around, you do what you want, you get out of bed late, you paint for a while, then you smoke. Smoking, I enjoyed smoking a great deal. And then you walk around, you look at stuff, and it's a life where you don't have any contact with people. I got away with not knowing anybody in the art world, pretty much, and I consider that great. And now we look back and see it was a big mistake, because you cannot get anywhere in art except knowing people, no matter how you paint. It seemed to me that if you need anybody, it means your paintings aren't good enough. You know what I mean? Like, if you need someone intelligent to stand beside your painting, then something's really wrong with your painting. So I was really, really totally arrogant, my attitude. And that's probably one of the main reasons why I don't know many artists. I mean, I wish I knew more, and I'm busily making friends with them now. However, select group.
Most artists, I would say, I'm not a drinker. I'm a pot smoker. And most artists want to sit and drink and talk about making art, and that just bores me to death. I'd rather be home smoking pot, making art, than the person.
That's right.
Do you smoke cigarettes still?
No. I don't smoke anything.
Okay.
I drink 2 glasses of red wine.
Every day?
It's good for
you.
Yeah,
in the evening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I drink 2 glasses of chocolate milk.
I'd like to have 5 or 6 glasses. I'd like to have 5 or 6 glasses, but it's forbidden.
That's where it has to cap it there. And Gary, what about, I mean, who were...
Communities?
Yeah, who was your...
Oh, I've got, like, friends all over the place, you know. I mean, it's just... From, I was on a little, not a farm, I was in a little town in Texas, and I had friends, but I just thought, there's got to be people out there that are crazy about art. And I met them along the way, you know, in art school. You go to art school, you end up knowing some of the people from art school for the rest of your life, I do. And then in punk rock, I met all these people, they're old punk rockers now. Really old.
Do you really know the people that you knew in art school still?
Yeah, some of them. I mean, it was in a performance art group with some of those guys, you know. And we took a lot of bad acid together and bonded and laid fish in the highway and stuff, you know. But I know a lot of people, but I'm very selfish with my time. And I want to be in my room making art. And Helene has to make me go out, you know. She gave up. She started going to movies with other people.
Women force us to live.
Yeah.
There's no getting out of it. Yeah. You got to be alive, yes.
If I wasn't married, it would be in a really horrible situation, I'm sure, of gross dirtiness, probably.
So was it difficult? I mean, you came up in the midst of this, and Peter, you were sort of mid-career while this happened, but the sort of, I went to see the MoMA's 1969 show at PS1. Which is interesting because of how gray it is and how the sort of onset of minimalism began to really push out painting and color in general. And I wondered how it was for each of you. This was, you know, it's a 20-year period practically.
What year? 69?
Like the late 60s into the late 80s, I guess, where it was sort of...
Minimalism?
And conceptualism kind of dominating.
Yeah, that's true.
Was it... difficult to be making that kind of work in that time? What was your take on all of it?
How do I feel about the art appreciation, you mean? Did I get
it? Yeah, or how it affected you.
Well, I was extremely arrogant towards it until very recently. Hmm. I'm going for the art appreciation now. I want more right now. However, at that time, I didn't mind. I thought it was pretty stupid, frankly. And you see it historically. I mean, for over 1,000 years, the purpose of looking at a picture is to see the image. And then all of a sudden, we have a change, right? And we're looking at the brushstrokes. How convincing is that, you know? I mean, you have 1,000 years of imagery, and then you have 50 or 100 years of looking at the brushstroke. It's just not convincing to me. It can't last because it's not humanly possible to be really interested in brushstrokes. I mean, you can, if you're an expert at brushstrokes, be interested in brushstrokes. But that's about the extent of it. And you can point out the money value. Say, hey, don't ignore that. That's worth $500,000, you know, or something like that. But, I mean, realistically, human interest in the brushstroke is zero. So it has to end. And the same with minimal. A lot of that stuff has to do with who owns it. I mean, if the object is owned by a significant person, and the interest in the object is built up astronomically. I found this myself, that if you don't sell, if you have not sold any object, period, zilch, the fascination that your object has for another person is quite little. On the other hand, if you can, if you have sold objects, a number of them, to someone, the interest goes astronomically high. And they look at it and they wonder, what the hell about this thing caused somebody to pay whatever, you know? They just can't figure it out.
Did you ever drive out to Marfa?
No, no.
Do you regret having not gone there?
No, no, no. I never go anywhere. My wife is in art school, working at Hunter, and so she's very interested in contemporary art. And so I see a whole lot of contemporary art, but I only view it when I have to, unless it's someone I know. If I know the person, I view the art. That's the way it is with me at this time. I can't go to Marfa. I can't even go to anywhere.
Well, you were in Austin.
I can't even
it's only 500 miles away from.
Even Chelsea, I rarely get to. I've never been to a gallery in Brooklyn. I've been in the Brooklyn Museum twice because for some reason Sally wanted to see some show that was there. And I accompanied.
It's very nice of you.
Noble.
You could get in trouble if you don't go.
Yeah.
I don't want to get in trouble.
Gary, what about you? I mean, I know you were affected by...
I'm kind of crazy about all of it in a way, you know? I mean,
I know you
again,
like Judd and...
Living through, being interested from the time I was 12 in 20th century art and then hitting the 60s and have it get rarefied. But it was interesting to me just to see that, like, if painting could be anything, like, then it led me to do comics, actually. It was like part of my...
How so?
I was studying painting in college, and I saw Zap Comics, and I thought, wow, this looks like... Because painting at that point, it could be putting a tin can in the desert, and that was fine with me. But, so anyway, I started making
true
comics, and then I got, you know, I mean, then you get labeled as an illustrator or a cartoonist or something, and the labels stick in a way. Designing the Pee-wee show sticks, you know, which is... It's fine, but it's a job. I don't know. What am I talking about? I have no idea now. I don't know. I like art. I'm a fan of art. Well, I got really excited by seeing Bruce Nauman's castings of his arms with a rope. I thought that was interesting stuff. It was just, not that I would go do that, but it was just that you could go
and
you could go many places.
I have felt interest in something for some reason. I don't want to sound too negative.
I don't know why I like his work, but I kind of do.
There was a writer named Booklow. Booklow, you know, he writes textbooks on art or something. I don't know, it's German, I think, who wrote an article in which he recommended that artists be de-skilled. And I thought, wow, how would that be to not be skilled? So I decided to go look at the guy, Clifford Still, in the Metropolitan. He seemed to be the most unskilled of all of those people. It's like he just put the paint on and who knows what's going to happen. It might dry this way, it might dry that way. It could be anything, you know? So I went and looked at him, but nobody would think that I would be interested, but I was. And I've also been interested in various artists that have nothing to do with my work. I don't want to sound too negative. I think if you need to see something, you just go look at it.
Yeah.
If you need to see. I don't look for stuff that I can copy or be influenced by. I just look for stuff that has a certain interest, right?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that gets me excited for reasons I don't know. Often I tend towards liking artists whose work changes over time. Mm-hmm. Your work changes over time. Eduardo Paolazzi, I keep coming back to because his work changed.
No, I'm not sure I changed. I've been accused of unchanging.
No, I think your
good.
Work
don't
changes
leave,
a bit.
Leave it at that. Ah, but, thanks. You too.
Yeah. I don't know. You look for stimulation where you can
that's
find
true.
It in a way. It doesn't have to be in, it could be in an art gallery, it could be in, you know, anywhere else.
Yes.
A vegetable store. It's very colorful. My wife loves it looking at fresh fruit.
It's hard to mix those colors.
Yeah, it is. I can't compete with that, so I stay away from fresh fruit.
I think we'll open it up to questions if anybody. Uh-oh. Does anyone have any questions?
Come on, you guys.
Oh,
you're
going to
come up after the thing's over, and you're going to go, oh, Mr. Saul, could I please just ask you what shoe polish you use?
What shoe polish you use?
I think this is very stimulating. I find this very stimulating, and I'll answer another one, and so will you. Just go ahead. They're slow with their questions. Let's ignore it.
Yeah. Fuck them.
Let's
they
ignore
don't have
it.
Questions.
Oh, wait, there's one.
Oh, okay.
Do you guys work on one painting at a time, or do you have, like, all kinds of stuff going on?
One at a time. When I had a big studio, then I could put four paintings up and walk back and forth. But I work in a bedroom, so I work the size I can work. It kind of, I don't know, yeah.
You guys cut a lot when you're painting?
What's that?
Like wait for something to dry?
In my case, no, but I do have to wait some. I mean, it can take a few minutes.
So what do you do when you're
painting? for a few minutes. In our place in the country, I have a library full of books that I browse in at random, like the life story of Cheryl Crane, the daughter of Lina Turner, you know, the one who stabbed Johnny Stompanato in the stomach. I got her story in a book form, and I also have a few shrink books and books of serial killers and stuff that I browse in at random. I just open it like that. And whatever is on the page, I read. I start reading, And as soon as I think the paint is dry, I put it back, go to the painting.
Do you have that book on, like, the transvestite case where the guy was interested in women with gigantic feet, and he, like, dressed up like women with giant feet?
No, I don't
have
that.
I'll have to show you.
I have a lot of them, though. I don't have a lot. I have a few.
the right words.
Did you have a question?
Are you constantly looking at your old stuff, or are you just kind of
that for both of you?
Yeah,
I'm always excited about the new thing I'm working on. Kind of, I'm always trying to make ammo for the new thing.
I guess I don't spend a lot of time looking at old stuff. No, very rare. That's a polite question.
Mr. Panter, you mentioned that you were drawn to artists who change over time.
Yeah.
Is there a reason for that? Do you feel like you've changed? Or what was...
I think life's short, you know, and you can, like, bang the same nail in with the same hammer forever. That's a legitimate thing to do. But I really think, you know, I'd like to try a few things before I kick the bucket, you know. It'd be nice. It'd be nice to live for 1,000 years, then you could actually get something done. You know? But so we can do a few things. Because I paint, what, maybe 10 paintings a year, maybe 15 paintings a year. Does that mean I'm going to do like 30 or 40 more paintings and I'm going to be dead? That's kind of a bummer, you know? So I'm gonna do some, make some more mini comics.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention this thing. I mentioned this to Peter before, but there was an interview of Frank Stella in the Believer magazine when he talks. I think he's referring to Peter probably when he says that ducks and women are always trying to get into his paintings and he doesn't let them in.
Oh, yeah.
So he must be jealous. I don't know.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, he's out there like doing everything in the world. If only he could let a duck in, it would like destroy his whole career.
I think he's got some guts, though, that guy, because he's the only one who, he was the first to ignore those stupid ideas that they used to have in the art forum, you know, like painting the last painting and the most complicated painting in the world, red, yellow, and blue. You know those articles that came out about 65, 69? He was the first to ignore that and just go his own way with a whole bunch of helpers, sort of an art team that he pays, you know, and they make stuff. And also, he's not afraid to make lousy-looking stuff. That interests me, because most of those people, they just don't make any moves. I think out of fear that they might make something lousy looking. But he's got this thing at the Metropolitan, I think they bought it, which is like a big retainer. You know those things they put in your mouth after you've had bands? It's a kind of a pink plastic. He's got a big pink plastic thing, about 30 feet long and 8 feet high, with various things on it, paintings or designs or things. Boy, it's really something. That interests me a lot. And I think it shows guts on his part and guts on the Metropolitan's part. Maybe. It's what I was saying. They're sentimental, you know. The world of fine arts is more sentimental. The world of commercial art, publishers, real estate agents and people like that, just brutal, you know. I've avoided it completely. I haven't had any contact with the commercial world.
Good idea.
I'm glad I didn't. Although it would be great to make comics, I didn't feel I had a story worth telling. It seems to me the hard part of comics is the story. I'm astonished at the number of people who are able to make a pretty interesting cover on their comic book. It's astronomical. I went in. It's just really good. I don't know whether they take a long time or a short time, but they're very good at it. And I'm impressed. However, then you open up the comic, and it's another matter, you know? There's no story at all most of the time. And when it is a story, it's about them in their neighborhood and how they don't like the corner grocer or something. It's just, like, unable to be interested. So I definitely have a hard time with the comics. And I do find when I paint, the words are the hardest part, because they might be outgrown during the course of the painting. And then you have to think up new words, and they have to fit exactly the space that the words, first words had. This has happened to me more than once, where I've got some words in the painting which I think are going to last for the whole painting. And then on the last few days, I realize they're lousy words. So then I have to think up better words that fill the exact same space. That takes time. It takes like 3 hours.
Gary, you tend to keep like speech, or you put words in paintings like compositionally, but not to actually mean anything. Whereas Peter actually,
Just kind of like, sometimes they mean things, but I'm trying not to tell stories in paintings. I'm trying to almost tell stories in paintings. I'm trying to do setups where you don't really know what the story is. But
why not tell the story?
Well, because I do comics, and I literally tell comics in the stories. But, I mean, there's kind of stories. If I paint a painting of a guy fighting a giant kangaroo, that's kind of a story. But you don't know how it turned out, because it's only one moment of him fighting the kangaroo.
He ought to explain why he's fighting the kangaroo.
He could.
Yeah.
A kangaroo killed my family.
There you go. It's a gift to the audience, to you.
I think we have time for one more question.
Well, I wanted to ask Peter about that, the words in the paintings, and do you really feel that after the 10,000 years or whatever of just plain pictures that we're incapable now of interpreting the man fighting the kangaroo?
I think it's a way of increasing the content of the picture more than anything. The whole point is to increase the content level. The brushstroke level has already been gone through during the last 70 years. We've been through that. And it's in good shape. There's no reason to feel bad about the brushstrokes or any or lack of them. But the content is not in good shape in fine arts. They timidly put a little bit in, you know. I want to go absolutely into the story, if I can, to the extent that one picture can go into a story. The next one I got is the guy has a champagne, this is not started, guy has a champagne bottle between his knees, and he's shaking it up like crazy, and then he goes like this, and the cork comes out, it goes through his head, and comes out the top, and just at that moment, his brain escapes, you know, on little arms and legs, it leaps out of the hole, just ahead of the cork, and it says, let me out of here. Okay, that's the next painting. But it needs the words for full oomphiness of content. Otherwise, you just have, well, you have less content than you could have had. And I think that that's like having less color than you could have had in 1960. In 1960, you need more color. And now you need more content. So.
Okay. That'll do it, guys. Thank you.
Gary will be signing books at 4 at Our Lady of Consolation Church.